in his own writing.
Of a name we chopped up yesterday, the name of Jonathan Swift. However, before I go on to that, it seems to me you might want to ask questions, or you might want me to say a little more about that double sheet that I gave out yesterday. This is, you remember, John Montague from the Rock Field. This could be interesting to us in all sorts of ways, and we must be careful to remember that we are interested in it only as a sidelight on Yeats. An interesting thing, for instance, is that John Montague was, for several years, a graduate student and subsequently an instructor in Berkeley, UC Berkeley. He is an Irish poet, therefore, to whom present procedures of modern American poetry are very much present to him. And though this particular passage doesn't show it very plainly, there are other passages in which he is, for instance, using on this Irish subject matter techniques of old Dr. William Carlos Williams, the American poet who died about 10 years ago. As I explained, the very way in which this is laid out on the page, four blocks of verse to a page like that, in such a way that we don't know how to read it, we don't know what order to read it in. And really, if you look, it doesn't matter. You can read it in any sort of order, and it still makes the same baffling sense. This is actually, in typography, visually, a delineation of the deadlock that he's talking about. He, Montague, is an Irish Roman Catholic Republican, those are his sympathies, but he's too good a poet to let that determine what it is he says about something like Derry, the city of Derry, over 300 years. Though his sympathies are plain, he's lived long enough with Ulster Presbyterian neighbours to realise that from their point of view too, the city of Derry is theirs, I'm sanctified by ancestral heroism on their part too, and hence the effect is really that of deadlock. Both sides are right, both sides are wrong, their court, whether they're Protestant or Catholic, they're caught in something which is the result of historical developments over which they have no control. This is perhaps most explicit at the bottom of the top right-hand piece. Twin race has petrified the volcanic ash of religious hatred. Notice that he doesn't even have any full stops. He has no punctuation, because to punctuate into sentences suggests that we can order this, we can get some sort of logical order and sequence out of it. And the whole point of the poem is that that is impossible in the given tangle of Irish politics, particularly in the north. The bottom left-hand piece is particularly interesting. It is a quotation from the way that the defenders of Derry spoke of their defence. It's 17th century language, arranged loosely into verse lines. Small shot hath poured like hail, the great guns shaken our walls. Spectral garrison, no children left, sick from eating horse flesh, vermin, curse fattened on the slain Irish, still flaunting the bloody flag of no surrender. And then going back to the 17th century language. God had made us an iron pillar and brazen walls against this land, which is characteristic, extreme Calvinist Protestant rhetoric, immediately out of the Old Testament, which, if you've read any of your own colonial history, you will recognize immediately. This is the sort of imagery which the New Englanders in the first century used to justify their presence against the Native American. And indeed, it helps to remember, we should make it plain, that these Protestants who held Derry through the long siege against an army were themselves not an army nor a military force, they were a civilian militia. In other words, they were like the lines of riflemen who in 1776 confronted the redcoats in Lexington and Concord. And again, you can make that imaginative adjustment if you want to, the sort of way that a really devoted Orangeman regards his tradition and the glory of it is like the way in which a patriotic American would still honor the men who fell at Concord and Lexington. One of the bottom of the right hand, I think, is clear. Symbol of Ulster. As I say, Derry is the place which symbolizes the precarious tragedy of the whole of Ulster, really. Symbol of Ulster, these sloping streets, blackened walls, sick at heart and seeking a sign, a flag-hung gloom of St. Columb's, which is the Protestant cathedral, flag-hung with the flags of long-vanished regiments. The brass eagle of the lectern bearing the Sermon on the Mount in its shoulders, where, of course, that is a really bitter irony, that the church, the old church, with its old flags, symbols of, therefore, violence through the centuries, should have on the lectern the scriptures open to precisely that page of the scriptures which tells you to love your neighbours, the Sermon on the Mount. In its shoulders, the shoulders of the lectern, a city that is set on a hill cannot be hid, which is also a quotation from scripture, though an ambiguous one. We turn to the other page, page 69, we have Columba's Derry. Ledge of angels, radiant oakwood, where the man, dove, knelt to master his fiery temper. Exile chastened, the bright candle of the O'Neills burns for my owner, lightens Scotland with beehive huts, glittering manuscripts, but he remembers his secret name, he who set his back on Ireland. Well, again, that very remote phase of Irish history and Derry history particularly we should now be familiar with. St. Columba, the first and greatest of the Irish missionaries in Ireland's great age, who, as this reminds us, having mortified the flesh so as to make himself fit for the saintly chore, Christianized Scotland from the island of Iona, which is a holy island off the Scottish coast. This is then an evocation of what Derry was before the Protestants ever came, when it was still entirely a Gaelic metropolis. It has a pun in the very name, St. Columba. Columba means in Latin dove, as in the French, modern French, coulomb. And so the man of dove in the fourth line. He only just made himself a dove, and naturally a fiery temper. He knelt to master his fiery temper by long mortification of the flesh to drive his arrogance out and to become as humble as a saint should be. The bright candle of the O'Neills burns for my owner where he has gone there. Like the Scotland with beehive huts, those are the characteristic cells that were built by the Irish missionaries. Of which some in a ruined state still survive from the Dark Ages and their monastic sites. And then, it's news to me, he remembers his secret name, he who set his back on Ireland. That is to say, That implies that the real Ink. Irish Catholic patriot could take the view that St. Columbus and Columbanus, St. Aidan and the rest who spilled out from Ireland at the great age and took their talents and virtues elsewhere were needed at home, set his back on Ireland. On the other side, in the top right-hand corner, we have an evocation of what Derry looked like, again, in the heroic age. I can't even pronounce these Irish words with any Irish names with any certainty. Something like, rearing westward, the great sun room of Inis Egan, coiling stones of Aelach's hill fort, higher than Tara, the high Nile dominating Ulath, the white cone of Slea's snack, sorrow veiled the silent fjord, is, well, that one really repeats it. As history's wind plucks a dynasty from the ramparts, bids arrival settlement rise. The great sun room, at any rate, is a very beautiful and extraordinary evocation, smallest possible compass of the, in fact, a very, very spacious and beautiful Loch Boyle, the Lorne estuary there. Lines of leaving, lines of returning, the long estuary of Loch Boyle, a ship motionless in wet darkness, mournfully hooting as a tender creeps to carry passengers back to Ireland. A child of four, this sad sea city, my landing place, the loneliness of Lear's white daughter's ice-crusted wings forever spread at the harbour mouth. There, again, there is this continual telescoping of history after seeing, after the evocation of Loch Boyle in perhaps the 5th century of our era, the next we have it immediately of the 20th century. And it's also autobiographical. Montagu was in fact born in the United States and was taken back when he was 4 years old. He recalls then being carried out a child of four. This was where they landed. Lear's white daughters, this is a reference to the sea god, the Neptune or Poseidon of ancient Irish mythology, Lear, the god of the sea in ancient Irish mythology. Then, finally, the last one on page 69 again gives you the other side, the side which is not his, but which you can enter into with sympathy. The way, the quite different way in which necessarily the Ulster Orange Man sees it. London's Derry. London's Derry. And here's some more 17th century quotation. Methought I saw Dido's colony building off Carthage. Culverin and Saker line strong walls, but local chiefs come raging in. O'Carn, O'Doherty, and Ferrara saw his visiting come. A new plantation, a new mythology. Lundy slides down a pear tree, and drum and fife trill of Einhier Bove. Don't ask me about London, because I don't understand. plainly, this is the Derry that was founded and refounded as London's Derry, that's taking the modern name of London Derry. And here is some of those early settlers justifying it, not in religious terms, but in imperial terms. Methought I saw Dido's colony, building of Carthage, which goes back to the whole Carthaginian Empire, as in particular commemorated throughout European history by Virgil's Aeneid. Dido, the famous sad queen, tragic queen of Carthage. Culverin and Saker are old types of light cannon. They line the strong walls, but you know, before they can establish themselves, of course, the Gaelic Irish raid and try to supplant them from across the loch. O'Doherty, and there's the acrid irony of O'Doherty's visiting card, that there are a sword. A new plantation, a new mythology. As drum and fife trill Orangia Boven, again, I don't know how to pronounce that, I'm just guessing at it. That is the Dutch, I take it. That is the Dutch war cry, Orangia. ruling house of the Netherlands is still, of course, the House of Orange, as we say it, as we anglicize it. We speak of William of Orange, and all the monarchs of Holland, up to the present ruling monarch, are in this dynasty, the Orange dynasty. And hence, the way in which orange is one of the three colours in the present flag of the Irish Republic, which is green, white and orange, because the flag symbolises a pious hope which, alas, is far from being realised, in which the green of traditional Catholic Ireland is balanced, the green is balanced by the orange, and in between there is the white of peace and reconciliation. That is to say, the flag of the Irish Republic represents the aspiration by which the old cultural and religious differences will at last be healed. It will be an Ireland as much for the Ulster Presbyterian, for whom the heraldic colour is orange, as for the Roman Catholic Republican, whose heraldic colour is green. The Ulster Protestants, accordingly, organise themselves and have organised themselves for years in what they call orange lodges, the Orange Order, which is a particular variant of international Freemasonry, and it is in many ways the most powerful binding force in Ulster Protestantism. The Orange Order is arranged as Freemasonry is arranged in orange lodges, each of them with its own history and its own traditions and its own heraldry. And on the 12th of July, which is perhaps the most inflammable date in the whole of the Irish year, it's the anniversary of the Boyne and of William of Orange's victory over James, the Orange Lodges march, they wear an orange sash from shoulder to under the armpit, and one of their fighting songs is "The Sash My Father Wore." Significance of these colours is a very immediate one. Here, for instance, from this other present-day Irish poet, Richard Murphy, who wrote The Battle of Arklam, from that poem, there is his little poem about Derry. It's called Orange March. In bowler hats and Sunday suits, orange sashes, polished boots, atavistic train bands come to blow the fife and beat the drum. Apprentices uplift their banner, true blue dyed with no surrender, claiming Ochrane as if they'd won last year, not 1691. On Belfast silk, Victoria gives Bibles to kneeling Zulu chiefs. Read the moral, note the date, the secret that made Britain great. Derry, Oakwood of bright angels, Londonderry, dingy walls, choked at night with fuck the Queen, bygone current. Bygone spleen. Any more questions? Any questions about that before we turn to Jonathan Swift? Okay, well, let's talk about Jonathan Swift. Swift, it came up yesterday, you remember? The Swift appear to have arrived in Ireland at almost precisely the same time as the first Yeats arrived there, that is to say some time about 1670. Jonathan Swift was born in Dublin, and again we don't know exactly where. In other words, Swift was purely by accident, as we may say, and on a mere technicality, born an Irishman. All the blood in him was English. They'd been established less than one generation at the time when he was born. Moreover, he was brought up, he spent all his young manhood in England. When he was compelled to return to Ireland, to Dublin, in middle age, as a disappointed man, it was distinctly a disappointment for him and almost a sort of exile. He took up his position as Dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin, very much as a second best. He had hoped for an English bishopric and would have got it if he hadn't backed the wrong political horse in English politics. Between 1711 and 1713, this is the peak of worldly success for Swift. This is the time when he was in close contact with, for instance, his great friend, the poet Alexander Pope, and with the ministers who at that time were ruling, the Tory ministers, who were their friends. But that Tory ministry lasted for only 2 years, and they came in, we won't go into that detail of English history, it doesn't matter. But during those 2 years, Swift was one of the most powerful men in England, behind the scenes, as an immediate advisor of the Queen's minister. The Queen died in 1713, and this is Queen Anne, as it happens, and this was the end of any Tory hopes in England for many generations. So, just because poor old lady popped off at the wrong time, Swift's worldly hopes were dashed, and he had to be content with, as I say, this really not very eminent church post, the Dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin. It involved him going across the Irish Sea and exiling himself from his friend, the highly intellectual and witty society that he was most at home in London. Pope, John Gay, who wrote The Beggar's Opera, Thomas Parnell, and others. And he resented it as exile. Nonetheless, when he got back to Ireland and began to get some sense of what Ireland was like, he turned himself into what we can only call an Irish patriot. He was, of course, a brilliantly powerful writer. Irony, sarcasm, and ridicule, both in verse and in prose. He had used this before in England on political and other matters. We all know about Gulliver's Travels, even if we haven't read it for a long time. When he got back to Ireland, he used these skills, in fact, on the part of the Irish. And when we say the Irish, we mean the Irish, not the Anglo-Irish. He sympathised with the indignities and injustices which had been visited and were continually being visited upon the Gaelic Roman Catholic Irish. Indeed, the Roman Catholic Irish. Some of them Gaelic, some of them Old English, you remember. There are Old English Catholics, too, who are also suffering for their religion in the island of his time. He campaigned against this. His most virulent and elaborate and famous satire is, has the famous, very famous title, A Modest Proposal. A Modest Proposal for Preventing the Children of Ireland from being a burden to their parents or country. And this is written with savage irony because it gradually emerges that his modest proposal is that the Irish should eat their own children. And this is offered as if it were the most judicious and rational way of solving the problems of the country. Really scarifying when it's taken as it was intended. Also published a series of pamphlets called the Drapier's Letters. These belong to the 1720s. The they're called the Drapier's Letters because they are, though the authorship of Swift was in fact an open secret, they are published as if they were written by an anonymous draper, merchant of Dublin, protesting against the way in which, as was normal, the home country was deliberately draining the commercial prosperity from the colony entirely to the service of the home country. Precisely the same issue, in fact, as was 50 or 60 years later to be the issue on which the American colonists finally threw off the British yoke. The whole business about the Boston Tea Party, the way in which really vindictive taxes and imposts were imposed upon the colonial economies in order to protect the prosperity of the whole country. Swift is a fascinating figure and a very, very mysterious one. Even his birth, the date of his birth is unknown, and his true parentage is unknown. His mother was certainly a Mrs. Swift, and the putative father, therefore, was a Mr. Smith who had died before the child was born. And there have been very elaborate and intricate biographical speculations about how he was really the illegitimate son of some much more prominent English person. In the same way, his sex life is a puzzle. We know there are two women in his life who... This is not of the first importance. You needn't put it into your notes. I'm just referring to it. And I am referring to it for a purpose. The two women in his life go by the two conventional names he found for them, Stella and Vanessa. Vanessa's real name was Esther Van Omri, and Stella's was, I can't for the moment remember. It seems plain that both these women were hopelessly enamored of him, and yet he never openly or overtly appears to have married or indeed even consummated the relationship with either of them. It seems the balance of probability now is very strongly that he did indeed marry Stella secretly. Why secretly, however? And did they have a normal married life? And why were there no children? And what was the true relationship between him and Vanessa? All of this is a mystery. It may be one of the more chivalrous explanations of this is that Tom Swift either had or imagined he had a physical infirmity which he had not the right to visit on another generation, and seems to have thought that he should not generate children. But that is still a puzzle. I mention it because you need to understand it for the Yeats text that I'm going to ask you to read over the weekend, which is a play, again a short play, and as it happens in prose, which is Yeats's most sustained tribute to Swift. The play is called The Worm Upon the Window Pane. And I'd like everybody to read that within the next week, the same way as you read The Dreaming of the Bones, from the collection of plays in the reserve shelf, on the window. And then there's a further mystery in Swift's life. What afflicted him in his last years? It's easy to say, you look at an old textbook, you'll say that he went mad. It appears not to have been that, in fact, but he certainly was not, for the last several years, was not in control of himself, either physically or mentally. And the horrifying story is told of people being brought to see the dean stumbling and falling about. As with so many of the 18th century insanity cases that we know about, it looks very much as if that all that was wrong with him was some entirely diagnosable malady of the inner ear, which affected his balance, something in fact which modern diagnosis and surgery could have put right in a very short time. And this is true of other of the most tragic madmen of the 18th century. At any rate, the significance of all this story, reminding you of it, because of course you, most of you will have encountered Jonathan Swift before in other courses, is that in Swift, and in one or two others who I'm going to mention in a moment, you see repeated precisely that pattern, you remember, which was so striking with the Anglo-Normans. That is to say, here is another sort of Anglo-Irish, centuries later, and a significant proportion of them are in the country of their adoption for less than a generation before they become, just as the Normans did, more Irish than the Irish. In the, just the same way as the Fitzgeralds, you remember, one would have supposed that they would all the time have been the agents of the Crown keeping the Gaelic Irish suppressed, in fact became Gaelicized. Well, in just the same way, Swift is the first of a series of brilliant Anglo-Irish men, most of whom came to Ireland, I mean, their families came to Ireland, only in the 17th century, who, within a generation, within less than a generation, in fact, ally themselves in sympathy and imagination with the dispossessed Roman Catholic Gaels. In the view of someone like Yeats himself, an Anglo-Irishman of this kind, these men who react in this way are, in many ways, the most noble people in the whole history of Ireland, because they stand up for Ireland, write for her, negotiate for her, fight for her sometimes and die for her, and in doing so are in fact quite consciously and plainly working against their own economic and political interests. The self-interest of Swift, or the name that I will now add to him, similar people through the next 100 years in Ireland, Bishop Berkeley, whom we met before, another of precisely the same sort. This is of course the great philosopher whose name is commemorated in the city of Berkeley, California. Oliver Goldsmith, the author of The Deserted Village, a friend of Dr. Johnson in the 1760s and 1770s, and Edmund Burke, the great political orator and man of letters and active politician in the last decades of the 18th century in London, 1760-1790. Burke is a different case because, you remember, the Burkes are in fact basically or ultimately Anglo-Norman people. The Burkes have been in Connacht since the 12th century. But all three are Protestants, and all three devote themselves to the interests of the people that, as it were, on a Marxist analysis, an analysis of sheer self-interest, of class interest, devote themselves to precisely those people in Ireland whom they, as it were, should have opposed if they followed merely their class interests. Thus, it's possible to say that these are there are many other names that we shall put with them. In fact, I'll add one more now, Wolf Tone. These are the noblest patriots of all because they were motivated by nothing but compassion and fair-mindedness. And after the Republic had been established, with Yeats' help, of course, when Yeats, as an Anglo-Irishman of this sort, found himself in a minority in the Republic, to some degree a victimized minority, I'll go into that later, he particularly allied himself with these people and with that splendid roll call of names. The clearest example of this, if you'd like to open your books, is on page 126. Thank you. This is a poem called Blood Under the Moon, which was written in 1928. It's an elaborate and complicated poem. Once again, as with other poems we've glanced at so far, I'm not going to give an account of it in toto here. The second section is the significant one, however. This is, incidentally, written deliberately out of the house which Yeats had then made for himself in the west of Ireland. He had taken over the ruined tower of an old Norman castle, Ballylee, Thor Ballylee, which he renovated and lived in for a while, never all the year round, but he used it as a sort of summer house. It still survives, it's now a sort of Yeats museum which you can go and see. And this is written deliberately there. This second section is about towers in general, including the tower that he is actually sitting and writing in. Alexandria's was a beacon tower on Babylon's, an image of the moving heavens, a logbook of the sun's journey and the moon's. And Shelley had his towers, thoughts, crowned powers, he called them once. I declare this tower is my symbol. I declare this winding, gyring, spiring treadmill of a stair is my ancestral stair. That Goldsmith and the Dean, Berkeley and Burke have travelled there. Swift beating on his breast in sibylline frenzy blind, because the heart in his blood-sodden breast had dragged him down into mankind. Goldsmith deliberately sipping of the honey pot of his mind. And haughtier-headed Burke, that proved the state a tree, that this unconquerable labyrinth of the birds, century after century, cast but dead leaves to mathematical equality. And God appointed Berkeley, that proved all things a dream, that this pragmatical, preposterous pig of a world, its furrow that so solid seem, must vanish on the instant if the mind but change its theme. Saeva indignatio and the labourers hire, the strength that gives our blood and state magnanimity of its own desire, everything that is not God consumed with intellectual fire. Well, I didn't read that very well. It's not easy to read those long lines and the impassioned delivery that they seem to demand. At any rate, after the first stanza here, which evokes some of the famous towers through history, Alexandria's beacon tower, the Pharos of Alexandria, the lighthouse at the opening of the harbour of Alexandria in northern Egypt, which is one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. A tower, the ziggurats in Babylon, which are these extraordinary monuments of the astronomical civilization that ancient Babylon achieved in the valley of the Euphrates. Then Shelley's towers, unlike, for instance, T.S. Eliot, Yeats was always devoted to the great romantic poet Shelley, and it is true that towers and solitary thinkers by moonlight and lamplight in the towers is indeed one of the images that crops up in Shelley's poetry most. After that, then we get into a strictly Irish, indeed strictly Anglo-Irish litany of names. Goldsmith and the Dean there means Dean Swift, Dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral. Berkeley and Burke have travelled there. There are the four names. And then he plays with them again. Swift then gets one, Swift beating on his breast, etc. Goldsmith, deliberately sitting at the honey pot of his mind. And then the next one, a haughtier headed Burke, that proved the state a tree. This, in fact, these three lines are very, very remarkable. A compression of what, not just for Yeats, but I think for all of us, is the central value, the central emphasis of Burke's vision of society and politics. To explicate that would involve giving a series of lectures about Edmund Burke, as a matter of fact, the most powerful mind that was ever devoted to English conservatism. The next three lines, God appointed Berkeley that proved all things a dream, is also an extraordinarily compact and compressed expression of Barclay's, the central contentions of Barclay's philosophy, though I will say that it is more, it's a more arguable interpretation of Berkeley than the previous one is about Burke. And finally, Saber Indignatio and the Labors Higher. Saber Indignatio, of course, is the tag, which, meaning savage indignation, which from ancient times has been said to be the motive force behind the noblest satire. The greatest satires are written out of saber indignatio, out of savage indignation. That is the passion which impels the great satirist to protest and ridicule. Hence it is the noblest thing you can apply to a satirist such as Swift was. And the labourer is higher. The labourer is worthy of this hire. Swift's main contention was precisely that the Irish labour was not given its right of what it deserved. It was worthy of its hire and it didn't get its hire. And this is only one of several places where this litany of names can be found, both in the poetry and in the prose. In fact, Yeats at this point was, I remember, a senator of the Irish Republic, and he spoke in the Senate. His Senate speeches have been collected. He spoke in the Senate in very much the same way. I mentioned that there was a sense in which the Anglo-Irish Protestants were, well, they were indeed a minority in the Republic, to some degree a victimized minority in this respect, that the rule that the laws of the Republic concerning divorce and also concerning contraception were, of course, the laws framed according to Roman Catholic principles at their least enlightened. Hence, the Anglo-Irish, the Protestant citizen of the Republic, could say, and rightly, that he was victimized. He had no access to contraceptive devices, couldn't practice birth control. I mean, he could, he did, by difficulty, getting it through the mails or crossing the border to buy it in a chemist shop in oppressed British Ireland. If he wanted to get a divorce, he was in even more difficulty. He could go to London and get a divorce in the British court, which would, however, not be recognised by his Irish neighbours when he went back there. Also, under the Republic, there was, as there still is, a censorship imposed, so that he couldn't always get the books he wanted because they were thought to be dirty books. In all of these ways, the Anglo-Irish Protestant in the South, in the Republic, was in fact victimised. And some of Yeats's speeches in the Senate are on this topic, speaking against the divorce bill, for instance, and saying, with his own sort of saeva indignatio in political oratory, we to whom you have done this thing, he says, we to whom you have done this thing are no ignoble people. We have preserved Ireland in generations. Comes the old litany again. We are the people of Swift, we are the people of Barclay, of Goldsmith, of Burton, of Wolf Tone. Another in your book, there's a little poem, short poem on page 131, which is quite explicit. Because poems are short, don't think that they are therefore irrelevant or trivial. Some of Yeats's finest poems are very short ones. The writing of a short poem with epigrammatic finality is one of the most difficult operations that traditional poetics can undertake, and Yeats is very fine. Swift's epitaph, 1931, 3 years later. Swift has sailed into his rest. Savage indignation there cannot lacerate his breast. Imitate him if you dare, world misunderstood traveller. He served human liberty. And you'll see more about what Swift meant for Yeats if you read the words on the window pane this afternoon or next week, as as I've asked. I may say that next week, thanks to the initiative of one of you, either Thursday or Friday of next week, not quite sure which, we'll have a little movie show. We've got from the Irish consulate a short movie about Sligo, the area where Yeats grew up, and which is a big deal, extremely instructive. And after we've done that, we'll have another little feed and have, perhaps the week after next, a brief quiz. We were talking about Milton Swift, the significance that he had for Yeats throughout his career, and you have read or are reading Yeats' display about him, the work on the window pane. Spoke of him as an example of a new sort of Anglo-Irishman who came, as the Yeatses did, to Ireland from England in the second half of the 17th century, and how in these new Anglo-Irish you'll find, in the case of many distinguished individuals, a recrudescence of precisely that pattern which we saw with the first Anglo-Irish, that's to say the Anglo-Norman. The way that some of these Anglo-Irish Protestants became, within one generation or two, or in Swift's own case, less than a generation, Irish patriots identifying themselves with the Gaelic Catholic majority in the country. There's one other point about Swift before we leave him. I hope he'll return to him in any case, but there's one other point we've made about him. You will have noticed that of late we have begun talking again in terms of Protestant and Catholic, Protestant and Roman Catholic. And you will remember that at an earlier stage, when we were talking about the early 17th century, we had not that simple duality, but a three-pronged structure: Roman Catholic, Papist, and here the Presbyterians of the North. Of the North and of Scotland. And here, supposedly, the Via Media, the middle way, the Church of England, the established church. This was up on the board when we were talking about how Charles I, at one and the same time, was at war, in fact, with his Scottish subjects on precisely a religious issue, whether they should have bishops or not. At the same time, as he was also, of course, trying to hold down in Ireland his Roman Catholic, the Roman Catholic majority. Now, you may ask, but what happened to all that? Has that three-pronged structure disappeared? Because we now appear to be talking in terms of Protestant and Catholic. Well, the truth seems to be no, that it hasn't disappeared. In moments of real crisis and total polarization, like that war between James II and William III on Irish soil, then we do tend to get it polarized into two, into simple Roman Catholic and Protestant. But in fact, whenever the tension is released, the Episcopalian in Ireland feels himself as alien from the, well, we call them Presbyterians, but the proper name is the dissenters, or the nonconformists, or they are, of course, the lineal descendants of the old Puritans. And this is particularly the case with people like the Yeatses and like Swift. The Yeatses, being set up as Dublin merchants, the next Yeats in the 18th century was also a merchant, but then there began a long, long period in which each, the eldest son in each generation, in fact, became a minister of the Church of Ireland, Anglican, Episcopalian. And in fact, they were, the Yeatses in the 19th century were identified through several generations as rectors of a little village called Drumcliff, just north of Sligo, which is the place where, by his own wish, W.B. Yeats lies interred under the epitaph which he composed for himself while he was still alive. An ugly church, but a very beautiful setting right under the great mountain of Ben Bulben and within 2 miles of the Atlantic coast in one of its most romantic and beautiful areas. This, I think, we shall see when we look at the film that Mr. Marx has got for us. And that, incidentally, will be on Thursday, usual time, but in room 300. This is the intention, that we then have a projectionist, and we'll see an Irish tourist documentary of the Yeats country, as we now call it. So that the Yeatses were distinctly Episcopalians all through. By the time you get to Yeats's own father, John Butler Yeats, we find a man who lost his faith, as so many intellectuals and artists did in the second half of the 19th century. Now, John Butler Yeats was, in fact, an agnostic. He was a painter and an intellectual and a very remarkable man who had an enormous influence upon his son. In the same way, W.B. Yeats seems never seriously to have considered the possibility of rejoining that church or any other Christian church. Nonetheless, the Episcopalian church, when one says that it is different from the Puritans, one is not talking in terms of dogma or doctrine or even church government. It is, it naturally nourishes a different style of life from the Puritan style. And again, one of Yeats' great-grandfather, in the middle of the 19th century, briefly attempted to minister here in the north, in Ulster, and liked it very little indeed. Culturally, in other words, this new sort of Anglo-Irishman, the Episcopalian Anglo-Irishman, finds more in common, he is more at home with his Roman Catholic neighbours than he is with his fellow Protestants of the north. A more relaxed, a more courtly and ceremonious and even ritualistic way of life is easier for the Episcopalian Church of England to identify with than with the austerity of the dissenting tradition, the Puritan tradition. Again, you can make an analogy, a partial one of course, but in American revolutionary history, where the Virginians were the leaders, the Virginian leaders were by and large Episcopalian, in the Episcopalian tradition. And as we know, within a few decades after achieving independence, the basic cultural difference and emphasis between the Virginians, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, and the Massachusetts interest, represented by Alexander Hamilton and John Adams, shows up. And indeed, I shall revert to that parallel, for what it's worth, in a little while, because there were some people, Episcopalian Anglo-Irishmen, in the towards the end of the 18th century, who were very much, really, of the same temper of mind and the same habit of life as a Jefferson or a Washington, and who knew this and who identified with the Virginian American insurrection against British rule. However, that's to anticipate. For the moment, just to say the last important thing about Swift, it is most important to realize what we too seldom do when we're studying him solely as a writer. We must understand that he was, first and foremost, a churchman. It was not for nothing that he was a dean of a cathedral in Dublin, that he hoped to be a bishop. This was not a cynical way of merely making his living. He was devoted to the interests of the church. And both in England and in Ireland, while he was in England and while he was in Ireland, he was not merely writing irony and satire, he was also writing sermons, some of which survive, and
They're quite unironical, as you would expect a sermon to be, but they are the writing of a man of genius. And in both places, both in England and in Ireland, he can see his politics make sense only when you realise that as far as he was concerned, it was the dissenters, the nonconformists, the Puritans, who posed the greater threat to his church than the Roman Catholics did. Thus, both in England and in Ireland, Swift stands for the middle way, but if we're going to switch off the middle, veer off the middle way at all, we have far more sympathy, in fact, with the Papists than we have with the Presbyterian Calvinists. And this is true of Yeats, too. One must not imagine that merely because he was a Protestant, he would therefore feel more at home in the Ulster Presbyterian North than among his Roman Catholic neighbours. This is quite untrue. The man whom I've mentioned, the poet of our own day, Richard Murphy, is particularly interesting because he is the only Irish poet now writing who represents still this tradition of Anglo-Irish Southern Episcopalian. And so I thought it was worthwhile to run off a couple of poems of Murphy's too. One of them, the one that I read on Friday, the Orange March, and the other on the other page, Green Martyrs, is one that by now you should be able to understand in terms of the Irish history of it doing. You might like to pick that up at the end of this class. To pick up the history, however, we move now into the 18th century. The defeat of James's French-Irish army, first at the Boyne and later at Offaly, and then the treaty by which Patrick Sarsfield led the great emigration of the wild beast from Limerick. This was the event, or the cluster of events, which really riveted the Protestant English ascendancy upon Roman Catholic Ireland for two centuries and more. It was a more total disaster for the Gaelic Catholic Ireland than any that they had suffered before. And for their part in, as the English saw it, rebellion, they were made to suffer very, very, very heavily indeed. In Irish history, the period that we now embark upon, to say most of the 18th century, from 1691, we defeated Offaly, to, well, something like 1776 or 78, is called the Age of the Penal Laws. That is to say, the Roman Catholics were penalised and harried as never before by the triumphant Protestant interest. In fact, for 20 or 30 years, the actual practice of Catholic worship, well, no, for longer than that, through the greater part of this period, in fact, the worship, Roman Catholic worship, was an offence by law. No Roman Catholic priest was supposed to practice Mass. Most of the, well, all the higher dignitaries, bishops, abbots, many of the priests too, were expelled from Ireland and forbidden to return under penalty of death. Yes.
Was this true in England as well?
No, this is strictly an Irish operation. No, the English Roman Catholics, though they were still suffered certain penalties, the great Swift's great friend Alexander Pope was raised a Roman Catholic, and he was under certain penalties. He could not that he ever chose to want to, but he could not, if he'd wanted, have become an officer in the Army or the Navy. He could not have taken government service and so on. So there were penalties indeed, again, both on Roman Catholics and on dissenters in England at this time, but nothing like as severe as in Ireland, as ferocious, I think we may say. These penalties were in fact so ferocious that they were in fact impracticable. That is to say, although Roman Catholic worship was forbidden by law, although most Roman Catholic clergy were banished the kingdom and forbidden to return on the penalty of death, most, they did allow about 1,000 priests. In fact, this was always impracticable, and after about 30 years, they no longer even tried to enforce it, for the most part. So that Catholic priests, Irish priests, some of them did filter back at considerable risk, and they did minister to their flocks. Nevertheless, all the church property, all the existing church property of Ireland, was taken over and made the property of the established church, the Church of Ireland, the Anglican and Episcopalian Church. Hence, these priests, when they came back, had no building to officiate in. You couldn't worship in a building. Mass was celebrated in open fields, under a hedge, in remote places. There were stories of an enlightened Protestant landlord who, in the pouring rain, finds a Roman priest ministering, trying to have Mass in the open air, in the weather, and he perfectly well could have, and strictly should have, denounced him to the authorities, and at least driven him off his land. But the story is, this is in the records of one of those Anglo-Irish landowning families, that the man, though he was in fact a very staunch Protestant, drove his cows out of the cowshed and allowed the priest in to officiate in the cowshed, which was a great luxury. This accounts for the fact that, for instance, both of the two medieval cathedrals of Dublin, still there, St. Patrick's Cathedral, Christ Church Cathedral, are cathedrals of the by now tiny minority of Episcopalians in Dublin. People don't realize that, of course, these had been, obviously, Roman Catholic cathedrals when they were instituted, when there was no alternative to Roman Catholicism. They remained Roman Catholic until at this point. All buildings of that sort, all the monasteries, all the churches, all the cathedrals, with whatever lands they had, were forbidden to the Roman Catholics who had built them centuries before and used them for their worship. They became the perquisite of the Episcopalians. Hence, Dublin's Roman Catholic pro-cathedral, as it is called, though it ministers to many, many times more Dubliners, is a relatively modern building. And in fact, you will find hardly any buildings in Ireland to this day now in use by the Roman Catholic Church, which do date back further than the middle of the 18th century, about 1750, because by 1750...